Thank you for putting up with my last minute running around. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, we're finishing up this very lengthy section. And before we even start there, there is a wonderful Reformed confession written in 1646, 1647, called the Westminster Confession and then the Westminster Catechism. The Catechism, in any tradition, is a tool used to instruct baptismal candidates on what the content of their faith is so that they know what they're entering into when they're baptized into faith. Do any of you know the first question of the Westminster Catechism? It is a very famous question to those of us who are nerdy enough to like catechisms and confessions, which means it's probably not famous at all to most, and I wouldn't expect, you know, you all to perhaps be in on this. You don't share that nerdness, but you might.
God made you?
No, sort of close. That's kind of, if you were to paraphrase it in Eugene Peterson's message, that is at the heart of it. It is, here it is. Remember, it's 1646. What is the chief end of man? Which, another way to say that is, what is life for? What are we here for? What is life about? What is the purpose of humankind? And that's a great first question to ask because it sets the stage for everything. And the answer, according to the Catechism, is equally famous, which means Madeline may have a paraphrase of it and the rest of us might not. But I bet since it's kind of come to mind, I heard some of you say, oh yeah, what is the chief end of man? We've heard that before. And the answer is to glorify God and enjoy God forever. What is the chief end of man? To glorify God and enjoy Him forever. That is an A++ answer. That is as good as you can get for a short answer. The challenge, as with all things, is in the tweaking out of, well, what does it mean to glorify God? And Paul's going to give us some help in that direction because everything he said about meat sacrificed to idols is going to reduce down to him saying, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do all things to the glory of God. You'll see that in verse 31. That's near the end of our reading tonight. So Paul's going to come to this wonderful principle. He's not coming up with it himself. You see this throughout the Old Testament and through sections of the New Testament. But it is his way to summarize everything he's said up to this point as we come to this conclusion of, in typical Pauline fashion, an elaborate and extensive and overly nuanced answer to what seemed to be a simple question. What about eating meat sacrificed to idols? That's the question the Corinthian church posed. And Paul, instead of simply saying yes or no, or here's a short answer, gives us three chapters in order to answer this because he wants to make sure that we've thought through the implications of our Christian faith. He wants us to not just have a right answer because you can only go so far with right answers, and you can actually use the right answers in the wrong way. That's what all of chapter 8 is about. He says, you know, everything is permissible. You do have liberty in all things, and yet not everything builds up. Not everything helps others. So you might have the right answer, but you might practice it in a way that it destroys your brother and sister. That it doesn't build up others around you. It helps you to live because you're fine, you're strong, but others are hurt by your actions because they don't understand them. And so Paul wants to start this whole thing out by saying, you know, everything's permissible, but just because you have the right answer doesn't mean you're going to apply it rightly. So watch out. Even the right answer can puff up. Knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. So he is preparing us for that wonderful chapter, which I know you all will love because we read it at every wedding, 1 Corinthians 13, that love chapter. For him, everything is leading toward what is it mean to be in a community of faith? Well, if I have prophecy, if I have gifts, if I can work miracles but have not love, I am nothing. I've done nothing. Nothing's been accomplished. So he's leading us there, and he's actually kind of foreshadowing it with this idea. You can have the right answer, but if you don't live that right answer in love toward others, you're going to end up destroying others, and so your right answer doesn't build up in love. It actually tears down. So he says, watch out. You may have the liberty, you may have the right answer, but you got to figure out how you're going to eat this meat sacrificed to idols, because the way you do this might harm others if they're not in the know like you. So sometimes you might to you, chapter 9, need to renounce your rights. You might have every right to, like he says, I have every right to be paid as a minister, but I renounce my right in order that I may have freedom. You might have every right to do any sort of thing, but Paul is showing us by example, he's willing to sacrifice his own rights, to sacrifice not doing what he knows is right. I've become all things to all people, to the Jew, a Jew, to the Greek, a Greek. I've sacrificed my own rights and my own comfort for the sake of others. So he's given us his example. And then he begins to, with that as the backbone, start answering the question. And last week or the week before, we had that super strong chapter 10, I guess it was last week, where Paul finally gives an answer you can bite down on. And he says, okay, when it comes to meat sacrificed to idols in pagan worship, in a pagan temple, run, don't walk. Flee. You're playing with fire. You're going back to your old ways. If we're talking about meat sacrificed to idols in its original context, in pagan worship, that's coming too close to the flame. You need to back off. You need to flee idolatry. But Paul knew that that wasn't the only place meat sacrificed to idols existed. It was out in the marketplace. If there was a glut of it during pagan worship, they put it out in the marketplace. It was sold there. It could be at any place you go to eat. The meat you eat most likely was sacrificed to some pagan idol, some pagan god, a god that the Christians had renounced. And so he wants to now further answer the question by not just talking about meat sacrificed to idols in a pagan temple, which is forbidden, but now he wants to talk about meat in private places and in public places. And that's what the remainder of this section is about. But at the end of it, he's going to give an overall principle that whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. So that's where he's leading. So he's going to give a couple of examples to round things out, because he's only answered the question in relationship to pagan worship. Now he talks about the very real challenge that the Corinthians would have with meat that was sold in the market. Meat that they would buy, meat that they would take to their own home. And he gives them this answer. Verse 23 is where we pick up from last week. All things are lawful. You see the quote? This is the Corinthian slogan. They've sort of got it from Paul because they are no longer under the law. So there is a sense in which this is true and Paul doesn't fight that. He just always adds to it. All things are lawful, but not all things are beneficial. All things are lawful, but not all things build up. You have freedom, but verse 24, do not seek your own advantage, but that of the other. So you have this old slogan, all things are permissible. Paul, in some way, kind of understands that. He's been teaching that you are free in Christ. But he understands that that freedom must be used for its proper purpose, and that is to glorify God, in a nutshell, which is to build up others, to serve others, to love others, to care for others, to make sure that you're being a channel of grace to others. So he says, you might have freedom to do a lot of things that others don't have freedom to, so watch out that you make sure that you don't hurt others with your freedom. So now he's going to give a couple examples that are very common to these people. The first one is eating meat in their own homes. Verse 25. Eat whatever is sold in the meat market, and all of it would have been sacrificed to some idol, without raising any question on the ground of conscience. For the earth, and now he's quoting Psalm 24, the earth and its fullness are the Lord's. Now you know who he's speaking to here. When he tells people, flee from idolatry, don't eat meat in the pagan temples, he's speaking to the strong Christians who say, hey, it's no big deal. We know there's no such thing as an idol. There are no pagan gods. I can do that. So he's addressed the strong Christians and saying, hey, watch out lest you fall. Don't think you're so strong. Don't be so cocky. Be careful of your pride. Flee it. Now he's speaking to the weaker because they're afraid that if they eat this meat associated with idolatry, they're going to be defiled. They're going to be disobeying their Lord. They're going to be in some way renouncing their commitment to Christ. And so he says, eat whatever, you know, anything, whatever sold in the meat market, without it raising any question on the ground of conscience. You don't have to sit there and think, I wonder, is there any of this meat that hasn't been sacrificed to idols? Do I ask the guy selling it, hey, is there any of this that didn't come from a pagan temple? He says, don't even ask that. that. Don't ask, don't tell. Don't raise the question. The question's not worth raising. Your conscience might want to raise it, but you ought not raise it. And here's his reason why, and it's a wonderful reason. It's wonderfully Jewish. Psalm 24, "For the earth is the Lord's and all it contains." So as soon as that meat leaves the idol's temple and sold at the market, guess what it becomes? Food. It's not idol food. It's just food. That's all it ever was in the first place. But at this point, it has, in Paul's mind, even though you could associate it with idolatry, it has no association with that. It is the Lord's. It is simply a good gift from God. And when you hear Paul saying this, giving this counsel, you realize how far he's moved from his Judaism. Because prior to his conversion to Christianity, Paul, as a Pharisee of Pharisees, would never have eaten a taste of meat unless it had been ritually slaughtered according to kosher laws. Never would have let it even come close to his presence. Now he says, eat whatever, don't ask any questions, it's all God's. He's become far more liberal than his Jewish background. The Mishnah, which is finally completed about the second century, but represents Jewish ways of behavior even during Christ's time. It's a commentary by rabbis on how to live. Says this about meat sacrificed to idols, and listen carefully. Meat or flesh, that's the same thing. Although we probably don't like to think when we're eating flesh. But you are, you vampire. Flesh that is entering in unto an idol is permitted, but what comes forth is forbidden. Which is to say nothing at all, because they're saying if it never goes into any idol worship, it's just fine. But if it comes out of the temple, you can't even touch it. It is defiled. Which is saying you better get it straight from the cow that you have. Because otherwise, you'll never know. Which is their way to guard their kosher laws. It has to be ritually slaughtered according to kosher law, so it's in line with the Torah, so that we keep covenant with God and we don't eat what we're not supposed to eat. Paul used to hold to that tightly, as did Peter, as did all the disciples. But Paul has moved to a position where he can say what he says here, eat whatever. If you remember Romans 14, I know and persuaded in the Lord that nothing is unclean in itself. And you realize the vast strides he's made in his understanding. He has, in many ways, to the Jew I became a Jew, but to the Gentile I become a Gentile. I can flip and flop all over the place because, you know, I'll stick with the strict tradition of my Jewish brothers if it's going to bother them to even be associated with this meat. I won't even eat meat if it bothers a Christian brother or sister who hasn't come to a full recognition that it's just meat. But at the end of the day, I'm telling you, no matter how weak you are, you're going to have to retrain your conscience because your conscience is overly sensitive. You're overthinking this. The earth is the Lord's. The food is the Lord's. This is just meat. You can eat it. And so at this point, you really see the strides he's taken. And I find that incredibly interesting when you consider where he's come from and where he's now at. Why? Because he wants to just freely do whatever he wants to do? Not at all. Because he wants to do everything to the glory of God. And part of that is having a witness to Gentiles to whom these meat issues are irrelevant. All right? So that's the first example, the meat from the market in the home. So in private, he says, do what you want. Which comes close to how we sometimes think about our liberties. Hey, in private, I'll do what I want. No one's going to know. It's my life. It's my time. It's my body. It's me. So I it's permissible. I'm not hurting anybody. So you know, there's that kind of idea. But then he moves to another situation that the Corinthians might encounter. What if you're at a neighbor's home? What if you're at someone's home and they serve meat? Do you need to ask if it's been sacrificed to idols, or do you just dig in? What do you do? So he gives this example. We're moving out of the private into a public setting, not a pagan temple, he's forbidden that, but a private setting at someone's house. Maybe a Christian brother or sister, it may be just someone they know in the Corinthian society. So, verse 27. If an unbeliever invites you to a meal, and by the way, that's important because our reflection will talk about this. Many people might want to say, an unbeliever invites me to a meal. Well, they're an unbeliever. What do I have to do with unbelievers? I mean, I'm trying to stay pure. I'm trying to be a good Christian. I'm trying to have a good witness. Well, Paul assumes that the Corinthian community will be connected to and invested in and working with unbelievers. That they're going to be a witness to the gospel in the midst of their world, not by having this ghetto where they insulate themselves, but by being part of Corinthian society. So he says, if an unbeliever invites you to a meal and you're disposed to go, eat whatever is set before you without raising any question on the ground of conscience. And so he almost says the same thing, but now he's not talking about the person's conscience, because he says, verse 28, but if someone says to you, hey, this has been offered in sacrifice, then do not eat it out of consideration for the one who informed you and for the sake of conscience. I mean the other's conscience, not your own. For why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? Now this is an interesting section that Paul presents and an interesting case example. He says you're at a neighbor's home, they're an unbeliever. They put out the meat. The first thing he says is don't put your host through the third degree by becoming a grade A meat inspector and saying, well, where'd this meat come from? I don't want to really press here, but I'm just curious, where's it come from? He said, don't be a meat inspector. It's not your job. You don't need to do that. I've already told you, you can eat whatever. It's the Lord. So don't do that. But then he says, if someone, and this someone could be the unbelieving host, this someone could be a fellow Christian who's also a guest. It could be an unbeliever who's a guest. It doesn't really matter who this other person is. But if that other person says, this meat's been sacrificed to an idol, Paul says, then don't eat it. Why? Not because of your conscience. Because obviously this has significance for them. And they see this either being as a compromise on your part, and you don't want to show compromise. They might not have the right answer and they might not understand your freedom to do it, but they obviously in their own conscience feel like you shouldn't, and they felt like they needed to bring that up. And so for their sake, not yours because you're free, but for their sake, don't eat. If they bring that up, you're going to show, okay, I'm committed to Christ, I won't do this. Or if it's a believing sibling who's sitting next to you and they still have a weak conscience, well, you don't want to hurt them. You go all the way back to chapter 8. You don't want to hurt them. So he refuses to eat. But it's interesting that it is their conscience that matters, not his. And so for Paul, the issue sometimes isn't what we feel or what we think is right or wrong, or even whether we have the freedom or not. It is to recognize a big part of doing all things for God's glory is to think about, how does this impact others around me? If they think this is a terrible testimony, if they've warned me about it, they must perceive that eating meat sacrificed to an idol is an offense. I'm not going to play their game. I'm not going to give them cause to be troubled or worried or to think that I'm somewhat half-hearted in my commitment. If they're going to go down that route, I'll go down that route. And I guess you could add parenthesis if I were Paul, and I probably never go to that person's place again. Because if they're going to tax me with, you know, their conscience and do that, then, you know, I'm not sure that I need to be visiting there again and again. Paul's real strong about this. You can almost hear the viper in verse 29. I mean the other's conscience, not your own. And it's this sentence, why should my liberty be subject to the judgment of someone else's conscience? You're not my conscience. I might have freedom to do this, but you, in your mind, don't think I do. And you might be offended if I do. So I'm not going to eat it. Not because I don't have the freedom to, I do. But I'm not going to trouble your conscience any more than it needs to be troubled. It's already wrong, and it's already troubled. So I'm just not going to add to this. So he's a little bit disturbed by this, because he gives this general principle in verse 30. If I partake with thankfulness, why should I be denounced because of that for which I give thanks? Paul uses two philosophies. One, the earth is the Lord and all it contains. The meat is the Lord's meat. Doesn't matter if it was sacrificed to an idol. And then he says, you know, when I eat from thankfulness, why should that be disturbed by someone who wants to make me less thankful? I'm thankful for this meat. I don't care who it was sacrificed to, because at the end of the day, the earth is the Lord's. So if I eat with thankfulness, why should I be denounced? He's saying what he's going to say more strongly in 1 Timothy 4. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected, provided it's received with thanksgiving, for it is sanctified by God's word and by prayer. So Paul says, I'm thankful for this, and so there you go. A lot of examples I could give you about this from my past in working through fundamentalism to where I am now, but if we have time for Q&A, I might share some of those with you, because I can tell you of many situations where this kind of philosophy applied to how I carried myself, particularly in a much more conservative setting. So, those are the two situations. Now, do you see the big three situations? Hey, strong Christians, eating meat in a pagan temple? No way. You're not that strong. Get over yourself. Hey, weak Christians that are afraid that if you're associated with this meat, you're going to be defiled and your faith will be compromised. You're not. Eat with gratitude and know it's God's. And if it ends up troubling someone with you, well then, you know, rethink your situation, because you don't want to hurt them. You want to build up others. So this is a case where the weak Christian might have to show some love to others by making room for how their behavior might impact them. Then he ends with this general principle, which is connected to everything he says. So, verse 31, which is a way of saying, I've come to my conclusion. Therefore, we're at the end. Here's the big wrap-up. Whether you eat or drink, or whatever you do, do everything to the glory of God. And what's amazing about this sentence is one word, panta, which means everything. And what's really interesting is how it connects to the beginning of verse 23. Panta are lawful. All things are lawful. Do panta all things to the glory of God. So Paul now has given his fullest expansion of, hey, you Corinthians say all things are lawful, and I tend to agree with you some with some reservations, with some qualifications, but my biggest qualification is this: all things are lawful, all things for the glory of God. That must be thought of in everything you do. And what Paul is desperately trying to do is he's trying to move the people of Corinth from an anthropocentric view, a man-centered view, a self-centered view, a view of it's all about me and my rights and what I think is right and wrong and my conscience, to thinking about things from a theocentric point of view, which is to say it's all about God and God's will, God's desire, what pleases God, what God longs for me to use my freedom for, what God longs for me to be as a free agent of grace, an object of mercy, an instrument of love in a world that God has created. Because the ultimate aim for any believer is to glorify God and enjoy God forever. So what does that mean? And Paul puts some legs on that in the remainder of this section. Verse 32. Give no offense to Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God. So one of the things, I hear the deliverance song and I'm getting scared. I've seen that movie and I know where that tune leads to. One of the things we're to do as we glorify God is we're to minimize offense. Which is interesting, because I know in my past some people who talk about glorifying God act like it's all about me and my righteousness and my spirituality and my passion for God. John Piper talks like that. It's all my passion for God. That's to glorify God. That's not how Paul views it. For him, glorifying God is how you treat others and how you live your life in the presence of others so that you're an agent of grace and mercy and love to them. And so he says, you want to glorify God in all things? Give no offense to people. Make sure that the way you behave doesn't destroy them. It doesn't bring them down. Because this isn't about you, it's about God. And it's about doing God's will. And in doing God's will, you are meant to be an instrument of grace and love and mercy. And so that means you think about how your behavior impacts others. You might have the right answer, but you can apply it wrongly. You might think that you know better because you're strong, but watch out lest that destroy someone who's weak, because they're also a brother. They're also beloved by Christ. Christ died for them too. And so he says, watch out, make sure you don't put a stumbling block, you don't give offense. And he includes all the categories he's talked about to Jews or to Greeks of the church of God. Because remember, he said, to the Jew I became a Jew, to the Greek I became a Greek, to the weak I became weak. Those weak people in the church that aren't quite there with these answers I'm giving you yet, and that they're part of the church and so strong, be careful for them. Think about how your behavior impacts them. He's including everybody because he wants everybody to be included. Strong, weak, Jew, Greek, it doesn't matter to Paul. He wants all of these people to get along and to learn to love one another in Christ, and thus his first hands and feet to glorifying God is all about making sure that you build up others. You don't give them offense. You don't cause them to stumble. He's not so much concerned that you're right and they're wrong. He's concerned that whatever you are holding to, you love. And you live in a way that builds up others, because that's how to glorify God. And then he really further intensifies that with the final statement, which, you know, in our society is really hard for us to hear without it seeming oppressive. But when you're talking about the will of God, we're talking about the most freeing thing there is. Verse 33, the end, just as I try, and he's using himself as an example, I try to please everyone in everything I do. Now he's talking about it being a people pleaser. In Galatians he'll say, you know, I'm not trying to be someone who pleases people when it comes to the truth, when it comes to the gospel. If it offends them as a scandal, I don't care. If they don't like me because of the gospel, I could care less, because I'm seeking to please God, not man. But here he's not talking like that. He's talking about trying in the church of Christ to keep people together. And so he says, I'm trying to make sure I don't offend anybody. I'm trying to please because I'm not seeking my own advantage, but that of the many, so that they may be saved. He wants to do what's best in glorifying God for the other, for that's how Jesus lives. He came not to be served, but to serve. He's trying to put himself in a place where everything he does is for the sake of building up the other. He's using his freedom for that end. Which, if you think about it, even a secular parent gets that. That if you're a parent and you love your child, you do things to build them up for the other. You take the freedom you have to leave them, not buy them stuff, get rid of them. You know, you could be as neglectful as you want to be before the law starts knocking at the door. But a good parent knows part of loving them is doing things, using the freedom I have in a way that seeks their welfare. Speaking at a child's level. Accommodating myself to their desires so we don't watch Rambo at the end of the night. We watch Toy Story. Because Rambo will really mess these kids up. But Toy Story won't mess them up as much. So, you know, it's that idea that Paul's giving here. And you realize, boy, glorifying God for Paul is a lot about how we treat the other, and a lot about how we put our interest in second place in order that we might serve others and help them be built up in Christ. Now, this isn't obviously about getting stomped on, but this is about knowing that there is a place in serving Christ and loving Christ to glorify God, and that in all things we probably can be an agent of grace and of mercy and love if we really put our thinking caps on. Because verse 23, again, all things are lawful, but verse 31, all things should glorify God. Paul ends this, and if you got a Bible version that, thankfully, our Pew Bible doesn't do this. It's interesting. Chapter divisions aren't in the scriptures. They don't show up to the 1500s. But here you find that verse 1 of the next chapter really is misplaced. It goes with this. So our NRSV does it right, and it throws in verse 1 at the end, because Paul has just said in verse 33, I try to please everyone. He's given himself as an example. So he ends this in saying, if this is how I'm living, I've given you some right answers. But right answers will only take you so far. I've given you some basic principles. Those will take you farther. I've helped you to think about how our faith applies to life. That'll serve you best. Because we all have to think about the different situations, and there's no one-size-fits-all answer for every situation. But then he ends by saying, and I present myself and my behavior as an example. I want you to imitate me. And he's told us how he's renounced his rights, and I've become all things to all people and in order that they may be saved. He's given us his own personal testimony. He says, imitate me, but in typical Paul fashion, imitate me as I imitate Christ. Because he puts himself in their place and says, I'm doing my best to follow Christ. I hope you see in me an attempt to try to build up rather than tear down others. I hope you see in me the attempt to try to renounce my rights at time in order that I might enter the world others live in and become a Greek to the Greek and a weak to the weak and all of that. And I hope you see that and understand there's a bigger issue behind this meat sacrifice to idols, and it's using our liberty wisely and well for the good of others and not for our own self. Selfish interest. That's different than how we in America look at freedom. It's all about my interest, serving my interest, my good. What matters is me and I have my rights and so forth. This is a totally different freedom. It is the freedom to finally be free of the bondage of our sins and to be open to being an instrument of grace and seeking to build up the other and understanding that their welfare matters just as much as my own. So, that's the end of our section. Paul has gone all over the place to come to this conclusion, but I hope in going through this with me, you've seen, with Paul, it's almost always, I'd say it's always, but it's always worth the ride. I mean, the where he takes us helps us to think about the issue in a much larger setting than just yes or no. You know, he makes it so that we have to learn to think Christianly along with him and to think deeply about our faith and what it means. And I appreciate that about Paul because, again, it would have been just easy for him to say, when you're alone, eat meat. When you're not, eat it unless someone gives you some trouble. And at a pagan's temple, don't eat it all. Thank you. Next item. He could have just simply done that, but he wants us to think more deeply than that, and he has bigger fish to fry because he's leading us to chapter 13 and he wants us to see, I don't care what your faith is, I don't care what you do, what your spiritual gifts are, I don't care what prophecies you have, I don't care what miracles you do, I don't care how dogmatic and orthodox you are, without faith, without love, you're nothing. Without love, it's all a waste of time. So he's leading us to that end, and he's showing us how liberty must serve love. So, three reflections, as always, because that's just the ordained number at this point. It needs to be three, and no less than three, not four, yay, not two. It must be three.
Five is right out.
Five is right out, that's right. Monty Python and the Holy Grail, if anyone needs a reference, you should at least see that 10 times in your life, or you're really missing out on a real treat. Three reflections. There's no easy answer to some things, even what you think might be an easy answer. And I think it's interesting that Paul gives such a nuanced argument to a simple question, that he throws in such theological depth and complexity, that he even refrains the discussion because they're just simply asking, can we eat meat sacrificed at the marketplace? Everything's permissible, so I would assume we can. And Paul wants to reframe it and move it out of being just about freedom to do everything to what's your freedom for? What does it mean to use your freedom wisely and well, and not just for your own self-interest, but for the good of others? He wants to challenge everybody, for those who are strong and they've got the right answer. It's just meat. It's just idols. There's no real other pagan god. He wants them to know, don't play with fire. He wants the weak to know, you don't have to be so sensitive. You don't have to be so tepid. Go ahead. Grab a slice of meat, especially when it's on sale, because nobody came to Apollos's, you know, big pagan sacrifice, so you're going to get a good bargain. Eat it. Don't ask questions. Just enjoy it. It's the Lord's. Partake with thankfulness. What's interesting is he gives the nuanced argument with the strong and the weak because he really does want the strong and the weak, the Jew and the Gentile, all to live together in harmony. For him, that's winning. That he has a church where people that are different abide together in unity and in love. And so he spends this time, I think, for good reason. But I guess what this has taught me, and it's not true of every issue, but I would suggest it's true for most issues. There really is, for most things, never any one silver bullet answer. One size fits all. This is just, you know, this is that. And so eat it, stomach it. And if you don't agree with it, you're probably going to hell anyway. There's nothing like that. There are people who speak like that and they seem very authoritative. Because when you speak that authoritative, it sounds like, you know, well, this person must know. They seem so confident of their answer. But I have found again and again, Jesus doesn't lend himself to easy answers. Paul doesn't lend himself to easy answers. They all understand there's a complexity to life, and it's better to think about general principles like do everything to the glory of God, make sure your freedom builds up others, than to simply just say, well, you can't do this, and you can do that. So I find that interesting, and I hope that helps you, because our world is full, particularly our media and our politicians are full of very easy, simple, silver bullet, one-thing solutions. And that's all that needs to be said. When really, the solution is probably very complex and nuanced and involves all kinds of issues from all kinds of sides. And I think if you're along with me for that comment, you get frustrated as I do. It's like, you know, there's more depth to this than 30 seconds soundbite, 7 second soundbite. The solution's not found in a slogan. It's just not. There's more to it than that. Can we think more deeply about this? And if our world's not going to, well, then let us do that, because that's our calling, to think Christianly. And that might involve some nuance. Second thing I think Paul's doing here, and it's very important to him, is he doesn't want the Christians living in a ghetto. It'd be very easy to say to the Christians, don't touch the meat at all. That's kind of scary. It at least is associated with idolatry. So why don't you all put yourself in a little Christian ghetto, have your own Christian cows and your Christian milk, and make sure that no one ever is in any way possibly kind of transgressing, and we always know where this meat's coming from, and we just make sure that everything's safe and nice. And Paul will not go with that answer. He refuses to let the Christians ghettoize themselves and become very closed in. He actually says, if an unbeliever invites you, go! Enjoy! He doesn't even mention you might be a witness. I assume that's part of it in his mind, but another part of his mind, that's just life. Go ahead. Be a part of the community, that we're not called to separate. And I think he's very careful in his answer to make sure that ghettoization doesn't happen, because it almost already has. If you go back 2 pages or 3 pages, page 169, just so you can see real quick, the Corinthian church has already made this ghetto mistake. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 9. Page 169, left column, second paragraph. 1 Corinthians 5, 9, for those of you who don't have the Pew Bible. I wrote to you, are you there? I wrote to you in my letter not to associate with sexually immoral persons. Not at all meaning the immoral of the world or the greedy or the robbers or idolaters, since you would then need to go out of the world. But I'm writing not to associate with anyone who bears the name brother or sister who does these things. So he's already had them misunderstand and think, oh, we can't be around idolaters? I guess that means we need to stay in this room. He's already had that. And he doesn't want to see them go there, because he's saying, I don't mean the people of this world. I mean, feel free, enjoy. You can't live any other way. And so he is making sure that in his ability to give them the liberty to eat meat without question, with full clean conscience, with thankfulness to God, that they can still live a proper life in Corinthian society, with one exception: they can't go in and worship Apollos. They can't go in and make sacrifice to Zeus. That makes sense. That's the one thing that's off limits. That really does undermine the testimony. But everything else, they're free to do. So their freedom is large, and they're meant to incorporate and be part of society. Which leads to the final reflection. Was Paul successful? Did his argument impact them? Or did the strong still continue to go to the pagan sacrifices? And did the weak still continue to think, you know, we just can't be around any of this. We're going to have to shut ourselves off. And there's evidence that he wasn't successful. 2 Corinthians chapter 6, and this is the last place I have you turn. That's the next letter we'll look at. It's written a few years after 1 Corinthians. 2 Corinthians chapter 6. I want you to see something, and we'll take further, deeper note of it when we get there. Chapter 6, verse 14. Paul is not able to revisit the Corinthians after writing the letter of 1 Corinthians. Something happens that trips him up, and he's not able to visit them. And in between the writing of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians, many in the Corinthian community, probably the strong, start denouncing Paul. They distance themselves. We don't like him. We like the super apostles. The super apostles let us get away with whatever we want. The super apostles tell us liberty is for our own self-interest. The super apostles aren't quite as harsh on us as Paul. We like these super apostles. And so we'll look at that in 2 Corinthians. It's the saddest book in the whole New Testament because it basically is Paul being deeply rejected and him trying to say, why are you guys rejecting me? I planted this church. I love you guys. Why do you all hate me now? Why are you so against me? Why have you abandoned what I'm doing for these so-called super apostles? So, verse 14 of chapter 6. The question is, was Paul successful? Did the strong stop going to the pagan idolatrous sacrifices? Did the weak get over their conscience? And he says in verse 14, do not be mismatched with unbelievers, for what partnership is there between righteousness and lawlessness? Now, I will submit to you, and I'll be even harsher when we get to this in person. This is not about, quote-unquote, marriage. Paul makes this comment, if you're going to marry, marry in the Lord, when he's writing to widowers and divorcees. So, this isn't about that, although people want to make that about that. This is about worshiping in idolatrous temples. Because he's already told them, flee it. But he has to remind them again because, listen, or what fellowship is there between light or darkness? What agreement does Christ have with Belial? That's a demon or a devil. What does a believer share with an unbeliever? What agreement has the temple of God with idols? And that's the issue. Because we all know Paul wants them to be involved in society. He's not saying get out of society, but he has to say strongly, why are you guys going back to the pagan temples and sacrificing and worshiping? What are you doing? Don't you understand? I said it before that that's danger. It's fire. It destroyed Israel again and again. Why are you guys doing this? Why are you, for we are the temple of the living God, it ends. Why are you taking the temple of the living God and putting it straight in the temple of Aphrodite, the goddess of love, and making your sacrifice as if it's no big deal to the temple of God that you are? Why are you doing this? So my point here is, was Paul successful? It doesn't seem so. What does that mean? It means that sometimes, as nuanced as your argument is, as clear as you are, as careful as you are in instructing people, getting people to behave, doing all things to the glory of God, is much more challenging than anything you can think. That this, you know, it's not just, he's given his best argument. Gosh, he's going to go on and talk about all things in love and getting along in the church. And at the end of the day, there will at least be a small faction that says, we don't care what Paul says. And he's going to have to re-engage with them again. And it's just to suggest that complex issues that require enormous self-sacrifice are not solved overnight. Our consciences aren't changed overnight. We have to retrain them, and it might take a while to think, well, it's okay to do this. It might take a while to get out of the habit of, you know, you're not strong enough to be there in the pagan idol temples making sacrifice. You think you are, but you're not. You'll see. You know, it takes a while sometimes for those things to finally hit us, and it seems like it took a while for it to hit at least a small faction, maybe large, but a small faction in the Corinthian community. Well, that's our section. It ends, and I hope you don't forget this, it ends with that wonderful saying, whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all things to God's glory. Think about the impact your behavior has on others. Think about how glorifying God means serving and building up others. You can be right in your thinking and still not glorify God if you're using your right behavior to destroy or harm others. That's nuanced. And yet it makes sense once you wrap your head around it. Now the challenge is to wrap our arms and legs and hands and feet around it and do our best to lean into how can we live and do everything to the glory of God. Would you pray with me?